Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon in here in Brussels and in Washington. Welcome to this Atlantic rendezvous. My name is Giles Merritt. I'm the Secretary General of Friends of Europe, and I'm sitting here in the Bibliothèque Solvay with an audience of people who have been involved in a whole series of different debates on European issues during the course of the day so far. And we're now turning our attention to China. And China is, of course, a constant drumbeat in almost all areas of EU-level policy discussions these days. Just about every topic that came up today, except immigration, seemed to have a China facet to it. So this afternoon in Brussels, this morning in Washington, we'll be debating the EU-US policy triangle. To what extent do the EU and the US see eye to eye on China? To what extent do we disagree? To what extent is China a divisive force? To what extent is it a new and positive influence on the world political and economic stage? I say that China is a constant drumbeat. It's also a constant feature in Friends of Europe's activities. We publish a journal called Europe's World, and the articles on China that have appeared so far are, I think, rather indicative of the way we worry about China. In the launch issue of Europe's World a year ago, we carried an article on how China could divide the West. In the summer issue, we carried another article, which the headline of which was China and Europe together could break the mold of world politics. And the thrust of the article was that culturally, it was written by a Chinese, culturally China and Europe were much closer than China and America ever could be. To test the areas where Americans and Europeans think alike or disagree profoundly, Friends of Europe and Gallup carried out a very interesting poll amongst fairly heavy hitters, you might say the policy elite people on both sides of the Atlantic. And I hope everybody's got a copy of the poll. But just to highlight one or two points that the poll made, because it showed a fascinating set of different and similar attitudes. This was taken before North Korea became a live problem with its nuclear test. But I think it already reflects the doubts that we have about security in Asia. In that poll, 46% of people on both sides of the Atlantic think that China will be flexing its military muscles more and more. And 57% of people on both sides of the Atlantic think that it's essential, with varying degrees of concern, that Europe start to play a much greater security role in East Asia. Another area where Europeans and Americans seem pretty much in agreement was on the environment. 70% of people thought that climate change is a key part of our relationship, both Washington and Brussels, with Beijing. That we've got to drive home in our dealings with China that the environment and climate change are key concerns of ours and must become key concerns of China's. So much for where things were agreed. Where did they disagree? There was a fundamental, profound disagreement in the key area of the economy. All of the European political elite asked, think that China has a positive role to play in the development of the world economy. 60% of the Americans asked were not so enthusiastic. In varying degrees, 60% of Americans are worried that China could have a negative effect on the world economy and certainly wouldn't be likely to help create employment and economic activity in other parts of the world than China. So, that's a snapshot of what people in Washington and New York think. The way we're going to structure today's hour or so of debate is, first of all, I'm going to turn to our two experts here. We're fortunate to have the two senior European Commission officials who actually have to deal with China on a day-to-day basis and can talk about how they see the European relationship and how they would like to see the triangular relationship developing. And I'm going to, on my far right is Hervé Jean-Jean, who's the Deputy Director General for Foreign Affairs, for Relations Extérieures in the European Commission. And on my immediate right is David O'Sullivan, who's Director General for Trade and very much concerned with the key dossier before us all in the with China and in the Doha round. And over in America, in Washington, I don't know if we're going to be switching to Washington, yes, we see the figure of Bates Gill, the man at the CSIS, Center for the Study of Center for International Security Studies. And Bates is going to be the lead speaker in Washington and will also, I hope, be helping me manage questions and interventions from the Washington end. The idea, although it's not set in concrete, is that we in Brussels put our questions to people in Washington. People in Washington put their questions to us in Brussels. As I say, it's not set in concrete to some degree. We'll be flexible about that. But the way we will proceed now is I'm going to ask first Hervé Jean-Jean, then David O'Sullivan, to give us their view on the policy triangle. Then we'll go over to Bates Gill. Then we will throw the debate open. So let's begin now by going straight away to Hervé Jean-Jean for some introductory remarks, then to David O'Sullivan, and then Bates, over to you. Hervé, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Giles. I'm very happy to be able to participate today in this discussion, and maybe to start with something other than trade. Not because I don't like trade. I like very much trade. I've been part of a team for a long time. But my feeling is that very often we tend to concentrate on trade issues in our relations with China, forgetting other major, if not the most important, challenges for our future in the relations with China. Second, if I were to base my intervention on the statement made last year by Bob Zelik, and the recent the outcome of the recent visit of Secretary Paulson to China, I would say that both the EU and the United States seem to be on a very parallel track with respect to the way they see how to handle their relations with China, i.e., we welcome China in the multilateral world. China is there, and it is a good thing for all of us, and we must cooperate with China to the maximum extent possible to help this country face the extraordinary challenges it has to face to become a strong economic partner, but also a strong and stable political partner. And here I would like to make a few points from that angle. China has certainly extremely high growth rates, and this is welcome. But at the same time, we must never forget that China, or the benefits of this growth, are not spread in an even fashion throughout the country. There are here clear challenges for the leadership in China, challenge to ensure that the wealth is distributed between the richest but also the poorest, challenge as well to ensure that the regional balance is reached. These days, if you look at Shanghai, you see that the GDP per capita is not very far, it's not even equal in parity of purchasing power, as the purchasing power of many regions most developed in Europe. If you take other regions in the far west of China, the situation is rather different. First challenge of the Chinese leadership, which will be of major importance for the future political stability in the country. The second challenge of the Chinese leadership is, I would say, the political transition. My impression these days is that we have a country where the Communist Party is still controlling all the decisions taken, and where there is a clear pressure from the bottom, from the people, to have more say in the conduct of the policy of the country. China has to build upon extremely difficult experiences in the past, which have left major wounds still relatively sensitive in the minds of leaders. Nevertheless, this second challenge, which is to ensure this democratic transition, ensure that the people have more say in their future, is for me one of the most, if not the most, difficult challenge for the teams currently in power in China. The third challenge which China has to face and for which we must cooperate with China is, of course, environment and the energy challenge. We will come back to this during the debate probably, and so I will not dwell on that too much at this stage. The fourth point which I wanted to make regards the position of China in the world. The leitmotif of the Chinese leadership has been, over the recent years, the peaceful rise of China, which is needed to accompany the internal process of development. Stability around China is necessary for the future of China. This leitmotif is now being somewhat adapted, and we see more and more references to the harmonious society concept, which deals both with the internal challenges of China and the external situation of China. One of the problems we have to deal today with China is that while on the one side we can consider that the insertion of China in the world system, in the global system, is harmonious, to some extent it is also not very harmonious. It is harmonious when we see that China is leading in the six-party talks. It is harmonious when we see that China is extremely helpful in the process on Iran. It is much less harmonious when we see that China is providing support to undemocratic regimes in Africa, is providing financial support to those regimes without following the international rules on development aid. It is also a source of concern when we look at the way China intends to expand abroad to get access to raw material, to oil. All this has to be managed and can be managed with China. China is learning extremely quickly. China has all the resources to effectively manage its external presence. But at the same time, there are experiences which China has not yet had and over which we need to discuss with China. And this is what we, from an EU standpoint, are trying to do through this cooperative stance which we have taken vis-à-vis China over the recent years, and which we'll try to further develop soon in the context of a new communication on China, which will be adopted by the Commission, which will deal both with the political and cooperation aspects and also the trade aspects. This is the only way forward with China, and I will be ready to develop those elements at the time of the questions, but I think I've already spoken 6, 7, 8 minutes, and that's by far too much. So, guys, I will stop here. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed, Hervé. Now we're going to go over. Well, first of all, I just want to go over to say good morning to Bates Gill, and just to test the equipment, because so far we haven't actually heard a word from Washington. So Bates, good morning.
Good
can
morning.
You can
everything
you hear me okay?
Everything seems to be working fine.
Excellent. Right. Now, did you want to come in at this stage, or would you rather we turn to David O'Sullivan? And so we have both barrels, so to speak, from the Commission, and then go to you in Washington. Does
sure.
that suit you?
Let's hear from sure. David. Let's hear from David.
Well, thank you, Giles. And in an outbreak of uncharacteristic harmony between foreign affairs and trade, I'd like to say I agree entirely with Hervé that while we are in the short term obsessed with the economic and the trade issues, the big strategic question is, of course, political and even security. China is destined to play a hugely important role in the 21st century, economically certainly, but in my view also politically and diplomatically. And I'm with Chris Patton. The only thing that would worry me more than a successful China would be an unsuccessful China. And I think that is the challenge. Of course, trade and investment will be one of the key means of integrating China into the global economy. I happen to believe I'm passionate about trade, but I'm also passionate about trade because I think it's an important lever of integration and of peaceful cooperation between nations. So it's not just about economics. And I think that the emergence of China is going to be an important element of the trade and investment landscape in the next 20 years. This is very clear. Of course, I understand that some people are currently focused on some of the disruptive elements of that. China is a very competitive and successful exporter. And we have the natural evolution of deficits, which of course give rise to criticism. We have the issue of the search for raw materials, which Hervé has touched upon, and people's concern that China and the scale of China, the sort of the swallowing up of increasingly scarce raw materials. But of course, the really interesting question into the 21st century from a business point of view is China as a market. I'm amazed that some of our business colleagues apparently think that China could be a more disruptive element or a negative element. I mean, this is potentially a source of enormous growth and export potential for the rest of the world. And of course, what Mr. Mandelson has been saying and will repeat in the communication which with Mrs. Ferrero-Waldner we'll adopt at the end of this month, is that we have to keep this balance in perspective. We have to understand that it is very important to allow China to make its way in the world. It is quite natural at this point of its development that China is having surpluses, that China is very competitive in certain product areas. Most countries trying to make their way out of relative poverty and along the development path towards prosperity pass through this process. And this is a positive and necessary part of China's evolution. Of course, it is not without risk, and it's not without its critics. There are those in the developed world who worry about China, but to be very frank, in the Doha negotiations, the elephant in the room of the Doha negotiations for many of the developing countries is China, because they fear that they are not going to be competitive with China in competing for the markets of the developed world. How we resolve that dilemma is one of the more important issues of the Doha round once the EU and US get agriculture sorted out, which I'm sure we will sometime very soon. So I think the issue is neither to be complacent nor naive about China, but on the other hand, to understand the strategic point that Hervé has been making and how to sell that to our populations. And I think here we have similar problems in Europe as you have in the United States. Namely, to get the dosage right between being sufficiently flexible, keeping our markets open, keeping the world trading system functioning, and allowing China to progress as it has very successfully, and to pull people out of poverty, and to develop a middle class, which in turn will raise some of the political issues that Hervé has raised and some of the governance issues that Hervé has raised, which is undoubtedly the big issue, how China will eventually make a transition from their current political structures to something, how shall I say, more pluralist? Is that a sufficient understatement? But how you do that, and at the same time keep public opinion in the OECD world satisfied that there is reciprocity, that China is open for business for exports. I'm not saying that you look for a sort of euro for euro match between imports and exports. But the more industry complains about the difficulty of doing business in China, the more there are difficulties about the extent to which the Chinese market is progressively opening up, the harder it becomes to defend keeping our markets open, which is what we intend to do. So we need a difficult dialogue with China of being sufficiently flexible to allow China the policy space it needs to develop and to pull its people out of poverty and to move along a path towards greater prosperity and growth. And at the same time, being able to demonstrate that there is progressive opening up of the Chinese market and that there is a balance in the relationship, even if it will continue to be, from an economic point of view, probably one-sided for some time to come, until China really takes off as a market. And I think the EU and the US face that challenge jointly. I don't know if there is an EU-US-China triangle. I think China is part of the challenge of global governance of the 21st century, and in that, obviously, Europe, the US, but other players also have important stakes. And how we manage these dialogues going into the 21st century will be a key challenge. I think that we have to be very careful to avoid any sense in which the EU and US gang up on China or create any sense of a common front against China. I think the issue is to bring China into a process of dialogue, and in particular on the economic and trade and investment side, to persuade China, which is not always easy, that progressive opening of the Chinese market and progressive liberalization is in China's self-interest, because let us not be naive, none of us do anything which we don't ultimately believe to be in our self-interest. The question is how you define self-interest and whether you define it in the short term or the medium or the longer term. And I think that's a discussion which we're continuously having with the Chinese administration. And I understand that they are tempted to take some measures in the short term, such as forced technology transfer or blocking investment and so forth, which might seem in the short term to have a certain economic value. I would suggest in the medium to long term it's a mistake, because in the end it doesn't create the kind of climate in which China can continue to export in those areas where it is most competitive. But this is a balance we will seek to find. But having said that, trade and investment will be an important part of the debate, but I'm under no illusion. What Hervé said at the beginning is absolutely right. This is a strategic, political question of global balance in the 21st century, and that's the message we have to give to our citizens about China's emerging role.
David, thank you very much. Now, Bates, we're going to go over to you. You're sitting there in the palatial splendor of the Gallup Organization's Washington headquarters. So you presumably have a copy of the Friends of Europe Gallup opinion survey of the political elite people on both sides of the Atlantic, as well as your sort of response to what you've heard from Hervé and David. I'd be interested to know what your reactions were to the poll, and specifically to that issue I raised of that rather strong divergence of views across the Atlantic on whether the Chinese economic boom is a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, thanks very much, Giles, and thanks also much, to Hervé and David for their remarks in opening this session. Let me speak first to the poll. I congratulate you on conducting that, and I, too, was struck to note that there seems to be, at least among the elites polled, this considerable area of agreement on questions of whether or not China is going to increasingly flex its military muscle, as you've worded it there, and, of course, this almost wide, complete consensus on the concerns we share over China's impact on global climate change. I'm not so surprised to see the major differences that we have about China as an economic player in the world. And I think maybe to just conclude on a few points in response to Hervé and David's points, I think it might be worth our time here to delve into some of these differences that we have, because they are important, even though there's considerable areas of consensus across the Atlantic. I mean, I don't think there's any disagreement between Washington and Brussels or between the United States and Europe that China is important, that it's becoming increasingly influential in the world, that its potential for better or for worse is remarkable, and that we share an interest in seeing both China's domestic transformation and its impact on the world stage move in a direction that's stable and productive. I mean, I don't think there's any disagreement there. The issues where we disagree, or where I think we ought to have at least a discussion here, is how do we get there? The approaches that the United States or Europe might take in assuring those obvious and, I think, important outcomes. And here's where I think we begin to see the emergence of some differences. Let me just speak to three, which we might consider as sort of tactics or areas of tactical effort in trying to work with China to see those positive outcomes come about. By and large, I think the United States sees China over the longer term not so much as an economic threat, although that's a part of it, but we clearly have stronger views on the security questions vis-a-vis China than have our European partners. There's good reasons for that. We have alliances out there in the region. We have certain security commitments to partners in the region, such as Taiwan, for example, which European partners simply do not have. That's not to say that Europe does not have security concerns about developments in East Asia. Clearly they have. But I would just suggest that because of our alliance relationships out there, the nature of our concerns about security in the region are different, and China is an important force upon how we look at those commitments, especially with regard to Taiwan, but obviously also with regard to Japan and the Korean Peninsula. Just here's a good concrete example. You're all aware that our Commerce Department is now contemplating new export control regulations, which would possibly place restrictions on some 47 new high-technology items which are not currently appearing on any export control list. And this is targeting China specifically. So this is an effort by our country to look at our economic relationship and impose certain restrictions on trade with China in particular because of our security concerns. Compare that, you know, to the arms embargo debate in recent years, and you see there's a real difference on how we look at some of these problems. Secondly, I think our European friends, and this is somewhere where I would be much more supportive of their approach, but there, I think we could say, generally speaking, there's a greater faith in multilateralism, there's a greater faith in dialogue, there's a greater faith in, let's call it, socialization processes on the international scene for bringing about positive change in other countries like China. Americans, I don't think, have, at least not in recent years, that strong a faith in those types of approaches, and I think that will differentiate then in the way we try to bring about those positive outcomes in China going forward. I think Americans probably have a greater hope that a bottom-up type of change in a place like China is more likely to bring about the positive outcomes we'd like than anything that might occur at an international socialization, multilateral dialogue type approach. A third point I would raise, I think our European friends are much more pragmatic in the way that they work with China. And this may have something to do with their historical experience in working with China, as opposed to what we might term a somewhat more ideological approach on the part of Americans in their hope to change China. There's a long history of American belief, especially with regard to China, both through religious movements as well as through our faith in the democratic process, that we can bring about positive changes in China through forces such as those. I don't see that impulse as strongly in Europe, although I think it is there, but it's just not as deeply held, I don't think, across the continent as it is, it seems, in our country. And again, that brings about differences in the way we approach China or try to seek the changes there that we would like. As a result of these and other issues, I think, while I definitely agree we agree in the long-term goals, what often arises, unfortunately, is in our tactics, sometimes those might differ. And we've seen in recent years where that has exploded into something of a mini-crisis in transatlantic relations, such as on the question of the arms embargo. I'm more encouraged today that we are talking with one another much more consistently and regularly and effectively. Dialogues like we're having right here are needed all the more as we both seek to work together. I agree not to team up on China, not to gang up on China, but we do share these common values and goals regarding China, and surely we need to increase our dialogue in a way across the Atlantic that at least we're not working across purposes, and we can try to work together in a consultative way to bring about those positive outcomes we'd like to see in China over time.
I want to offer Hervé and David an opportunity to comment on what you just said, but before that, I'd like to ask you two specific questions just to continue with what you were saying. The first is about North Korea. Can you hear me? I don't get the impression. Bates, can you hear me at all?
Now I can, yes.
It doesn't look
now
like
I can,
you can
yes.
hear me. Well, it's rather difficult asking questions of somebody who apparently can't hear.
I can hear you.
But I don't know.
I can hear you.
Bates, do wave your hand if you can hear me.
I can hear you.
Excellent.
I can hear you.
Perfect. Right. So I was saying, before asking Hervé and David to respond to some of the points you've raised, I'd like to ask you two specific questions. Question number one, about North Korea. Should we look at the crisis over North Korea's nuclear test and its potential emergence as a nuclear power? Should we look at that as a new cement that is going to bring Washington, Brussels, and Beijing together in perhaps as dramatic a way as Iraq tended to push us apart, certainly us and Brussels and Washington? Second question, on trade. If Doha is going to collapse, what should we do about trade with China, both us in Europe and you in America?
Thanks very much, Giles. I surely hope that the recent events in North Korea, the purported test of a nuclear device there, will bring what I would call a kind of new clarity to the situation in a way that's going to bring us together and not drive us apart. I think we've already seen that in the response that China has made thus far, such as in the UN Security Council, as well as in its own public statements, that it is prepared to move much closer to approaches that the United States would advocate, and I assume that the Europeans would advocate as well. So I think we can have some hope there. I would add that given the long-standing presence of European diplomatic missions in North Korea, that Europe can play a very special role here. Unfortunately, at this time, Europe is not considered a part of the principal process which we've undertaken there, and that would be the six-party talks. But Europe has played a very positive role in the past, for example, at the time of the Korean Energy Development Organization, and again, through long-standing presence in Pyongyang, I would think can play a very, very important role in informing the process that we need to take, for example, in the UN Security Council, or even bilaterally between the United States and North Korea, to bring about change in what's transpiring there, and try to roll back, if it's going to be possible, roll back in a verifiable manner the North Korean nuclear ambition. So I'm hopeful that this will not be a divisive issue, as Iraq unfortunately was for transatlantic relations. On the trade question, you know, I share your pessimism that the Doha round is not going to reach the goals that we'd like, that we're going to have to rethink the global trading system, and China's absolutely going to have to be a central part of that. I mean, I'm hopeful that through a number of potentially other processes, for example, engaging China much more actively in the G8 process, by bringing China in much more actively and productively into other global economic structures such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, that at least we can gain the benefit of having China more embedded and committed to a stable global economic trading and financial system. I mean, that's obviously we can't continue in a system that sort of pretends that China is not there, at least within the formal structures which govern or try to govern the international economic system. So I think China understands that the global trade imbalances that it is centrally a part of is something it has to change. We understand that there are many in China who take seriously the need to revalue its currency. There are many in China who take seriously the need to expand China's domestic economic consumption and demand. It's going to take time and patience, and I think you're quite right to suggest that by positively including China as a player at the table, we can expect, hopefully, movement on this in a direction we'd like to see.
Turn to David O'Sullivan and ask him the same question. David, what do we do if Doha collapses?
That's a hypothetical question I'm not allowed to answer, Giles. As you know, I would not be so complacent as Bates was, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I think we have a particular responsibility in Brussels and in Washington to think very hard about the consequences of failing to do the Doha deal in the next few months. Of course, if we don't, then the sun will rise the next morning, the world will still turn, and it won't necessarily be the end of civilization as we know it. But there will be huge systemic consequences for the WTO, for the multilateral trading system. And in the first instance, it won't be China, it won't be the US, it won't be the European Union that is the loser in that. It will be the developing countries, it'll be the poorest. And I think, but we will progressively lose out as they lose out moving forward 5 or 6 years from now. So I really would not want to leave any message here other than that I think we really have to work very, very hard to try to salvage this deal. I know it's not easy, though I sometimes worry that what is dividing us is that part of our respective economies which is the least important and not the forward-looking and future part of our economies. And I find that surprising and frustrating on both sides. I'm not trying to recriminate. But I do think that building China into the world trading system is a crucial element. I have less faith in the G8 or other processes that you mention as the economic reality of trade and investment and ties that bind people irreversibly with a common sense of economic destiny, which is ultimately, in my view, what does reduce the risk of conflict and tension. So I think trade is not the most important issue with China, because I agree it is the strategic questions you've mentioned, but it is probably for the next 15, 20 years, the most important instrument we have to try and achieve the political goals, which I think Bates has set out very well. Just one final point. I think probably in Europe we are more comfortable with China's emergence, not just for what you said about our like of multilateralism, but probably because we're more comfortable with the concept of a multipolar world than perhaps someone who is sitting in the capital of a superpower might be. And that's probably another explanation of some nuance between us.
Hervé.
Yes, I mean, three very brief remarks. When listening to Bates, as a matter of fact, on two issues he mentioned, I think it's a problem of culture, not a problem really of approach, and I think that on substance we agree. I mean, nobody disagrees that we need to have democracy in China. Well, when we discuss that, we can have various approaches, and I think that they are more complementary than different, probably. So, cultural differences, that's fine. That's necessary in this world, and it's even useful. I would like to make two other comments on Taiwan. I mean, it's true that we have not the same security commitments as the United States in the region. But I would like to draw your attention to the evolution of the thinking in Europe. First, at the time of the anti-secession law, the European Union has taken a very strong stance on the adoption of these legislations and the risks which this might entail for the development of the bilateral relationship. And we have strongly supported the various initiatives which have been taken on both sides to resume the dialogue. And you see more and more that Europe is present these days through statements, not through other actions in the region. But let me underline the fact that we are now in Aceh, that we will become soon also a member of the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation to participate in the East Asia Summit. Therefore, there is movement on our side. Last point, the arms embargo. I don't want to reopen the discussion here, but let me just say that I think it's more a problem of communication than anything else. I've never heard from anybody a statement explaining that the so-called code of conduct and toolbox of the EU were very favorable to China as compared with arms embargo. I would like to hear about that. I don't think I've heard anything about that for the time being, and that debate has been now lasting for more than 2 years.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Elvie. Now, Bates, I was very remiss at the beginning of this debate. I failed to explain to you and your colleagues in Washington that this transatlantic debate is actually, for us here in Brussels, the curtain raiser for a roundtable discussion that we will be having in about an hour's time, which is on defining a new EU-China partnership. And we've got a high-level team of some eight heavy hitters from Beijing who've come to Brussels to take part in that debate. What I would like to ask you, just to set the scene for our debate, is a very simple question. Do Americans care about the EU-China relationship? Partly I asked this question on the basis of the last 6 years of an administration that has not gone out of its way to build bridges across the Atlantic. Partly I ask the question because I feel that there is a cultural difference. America looks west to China. When we look west, we see America. When you look west, you see China. It seems to me that we have never somehow put our heads together. We Europeans, you Americans, and looked at the China relationship jointly. Is that a fair or an unfair statement?
I think it's a great question. And the short answer, I suppose, is that by and large, Americans, to the degree they do, quote-unquote, care about Europe-China relations, in my view, care about it for the wrong reasons, care about it for negative reasons. Unfortunately, for a host of reasons that we don't have time to discuss, but which you have alluded to, I think, our attention has not been focused on the important and dynamic changes that are taking place, and I think largely positive changes that have taken place in Europe-China relations in a very, very short period of time, just over the past 5 years or so. And I think they do have important implications for Americans, but by and large have not been given the kind of attention they deserve. There are a handful of persons in the United States who are laboring in this vineyard and are trying to bring these issues to greater prominence and attention here in Washington, D.C., and there's been some limited success in that, I would say. Most of the current positive developments, for example, the establishment of a formal transatlantic dialogue on Asia between Washington and Brussels, we should see as a positive development, but that really emerged, by and large, out of a negative development, and that was the arms embargo mini-crisis, which we had a year and a half ago. But we should take that silver lining for what it is and try to make it bigger and make sure that this newly emergent dialogue between our two countries on Asia is expanded and made more serious. So I think we're moving in the right direction now. I think Americans will, over time, increasingly come to recognize not only the importance of China-European relations, but I think we will, and we are, moving in the direction of embracing, finding ways that our two our capitals can consult more effectively with one another to assure the kinds of outcomes in China that we'd like to see. But we're at an early stage in that process, I think, and we should do all we can as citizens and as analysts and as officials to really encourage this process to become deeper across the Atlantic.
Thank you very much. I think we're now going to open up the debate to questions and comments on both sides of the Atlantic. I know that Dr. Zhongxi Ran from the China Institute of International Studies is keen to put a question. So have we got some way of getting Dr. Ran on screen?
Thank you, Chair. As a matter of fact, I have one observation and then followed by a question. My observation is that, in my view, China will be very much preoccupied by two kinds of challenges. One is internal, the other external. Basically, internal, the challenges will come from two fronts. The first one will be the employment, which might sound a little weird. You know, as a matter of fact, China, every year, we need to create more than 10 million new jobs in order to, stabilize the situation. And this matter could become complicated as the urbanization is moving forward. Secondly, the second front will be how to change the growth mode of China. We can no longer to afford the black GDP growth. We need a greener GDP growth. This is very important. On the external front, that is to say, China's relations with the outside world, particularly with its neighboring area, and also with other major powers, namely Europe and America, how these relations could be managed in a positive way so that that could be conducive to China's stability and prosperity. So this observation actually brings me to a question to the panelist. That is to say, I'm aware of that. There are some of the observation that given the fact the recent intensified China-EU relations, there is a concern in Washington and somewhere else that China may try intentionally develop its relations with the Europeans in order to create a counterbalance against Washington. And so we have seen that Washington has worked very intensified recently to promote their relations across the transatlantic. Very recently, particularly last year, we have seen American and the EU conducted the first ever such kind of strategic dialogue. And I'm sure that China is one of the major topics on this. But as the chair just mentioned in his very first remarks, the question is China going to divide the transatlantic? But here my concern actually is the opposite. It might be the alternative, that is that China might bring the West together. So my question, be more specific. You say Europe and America should work more closely towards China. So that is how to convince the Chinese, how to convince Beijing that your efforts are working and intensify the cooperation in a positive way towards China. And my question goes to Brussels and Washington. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's start with you, Bates, and then we'll go to Hervé and David.
Would you like me to go first?
Yes, please.
Giles? I can be very brief, and I want to welcome our friends from China in Brussels as well. I think the answer to your question is that we all must work, all three parties must work, to define shared interests. And I think posing the question as an us against them or you against me dynamic is the wrong approach. And I think we've all noted that clearly, both in Europe and in Washington, that is the wrong way to go about this. There are obviously a range of interests, both on China's external and internal agendas, that all three of these major parties have in common. For example, we share a common goal on China's internal agenda that its remarkable socioeconomic and socio-political transformation proceed in a way that's stable, proceed in a way that allows for the Chinese government to become more responsive to the needs of its citizens and proceeds in a way that does not result in sort of external problems, for example, through the spread of infectious disease, pollution, etc. We share very clear common interests to work on those kinds of goals. And, of course, on the external agenda, we share a number of common goals as well. We don't have to go into detail. I think we know what they are. The key is to build trust then across these three parties in a way that we can move ahead in very concrete ways. We talk about these things a lot. I don't think we've yet been able to find more concrete ways to be able to address these common interests. But I think that's where we have to start. We have to start by understanding we share common interests. We have considerable resources at our disposal in Europe, in the United States, and China to address those interests, and we should formulate more concrete ways to do so.
Thank you very much indeed. David is nodding his head, or was nodding his head vigorously, so I'm going to turn to him. But before I do, could I ask you, Bates, do you have anybody in Washington who wants to raise any particular issues or put questions to us on this side of the Atlantic?
It looks to me like there are several. It looks to me like there are...
We'll go to David, and then I'll come back to you and ask you to field the questions to us.
Well, yes, I was nodding. I agree entirely. I mean, I think if you look at the sort of intersection of interests between EU and China and the U.S., and then EU and US vis-a-vis China, you will see there are some things where there are commonality of interest between the EU and US. I mean, you've mentioned some of the political ones, but there are also some common economic interests. But equally, there are times when there's more commonality of view between the EU and China or between China and the US. So I think I was trying to say that earlier. I think it's very important not to imagine that it's a kind of EU-US dialogue with China. It's a three-way dialogue. I would even say it's a broader dialogue than that because China's influence in the world affects many other countries, for example, the developing world. So I don't think, in the short term at least, there's any great risk in response to the question that we're going to sort of be ganging up neither dividing us nor forcing us together. I think the issues are much more complex and the divergence of interests across different subjects are such that there will always be some commonality but also some divergence of view across all the actors.
Thank you very much, David. Bates, let's go over to you for your questions. I've got Professor Ma here who wants to come in and also Jim Clifton, but let's take a roundup of questions and comments
sure.
from Washington.
There's a gentleman at the microphone now.
My name is Brian Beery. I'm a journalist for Europolitics. Chancellor Angela Merkel recently spoke about having a free trade zone between the EU and the US. In light of the problems with Doha, I'm just wondering what the panel thinks about that idea. There hasn't really been much reaction from Brussels to it so far.
Would you care
to take another question?
Any more?
Would you care to take another question or...
Any more comments or questions?
Yep. I'm a Dutchman and a European, so I thank Bates Gill for letting me speak on this side of the Atlantic. A major challenge in U.S. and EU relations with China is policy towards Taiwan. The present one-China policy was devised in the 1970s when two governments, the CCP and the Kuomintang, we're competing for sovereignty over all of China. Since then, Taiwan has gone through a major democratic transition and now wants to be accepted as a full and equal member in the international community. When and how will the US and Europe move towards normalization with Taiwan? Can the US and Europe work together in helping bring Taiwan in as a full member in the international community and thereby set a good example for China to move towards democracy?
Thank you very much. Any more from Washington?
I think we'll ask one more person to raise a question, then we can go back to you.
Chris Stewart with the Gallup Organization. For Mr. O'Sullivan, this summer we had a a new partnership developed between the EU and the U.S. on counterfeiting and piracy issues. And specifically, last week, the EU published a new report, a new priority on counterfeiting and piracy, and named China as one of the lead countries to address. I'd like to ask you, what is the EU doing to bring China into the fold on this issue, particularly in light of recent comments and recent actions by Secretary Paulson that indicate perhaps the U.S. is backing off some on this issue?
Thank you very much. Let's bring the questions back here. I've got two. The first from Ambassador Zhen Gangma, the head of the China Institute of International Studies, Professor Ma. And then we'll go to Jim Clifton.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I just want to make some comment. I'm not going to ask questions. Frank speaking, when I started the region program, I thought there must be a discussion on the relations among China, EU, and China. And after my listening to the presentation, the question, I really feel that China is subject to be studied by the United States and Europe together. And so actually there's not a triangle relations of China, EU, and US, because China has not been treated as equal partner in the whole thing. And I really also found very interesting, because I've been to international conference or meetings like that many, many times. And very frank, I heard questions, comments about China almost basically the same. Over the years and years, our European or American colleagues almost always are concerned with the same question or same kind of question with some new development. One colleague just now asked about Taiwan issue. I think the Chinese people have presented our stand on that pretty clear. And Taiwan is not an independent country. From history, from fact, that's part of China. Now, even still now, our friends ask how Europe and United States will help Taiwan to be an independent country and to remote China. So in such a case, I think the relation would be very hard to really have to be improved, because China is some a country for Europe or United States to handle, to change, look upon. We are not treated as an equal partner or equal player in the international arena. I think this is not a very healthy way. And China is developing because our people want to get our life improved. We want to have a peaceful, fruitful, affluent life. So we must work hard. And we mainly rely on the Chinese people's own power. At the same time, we have done our best to develop cooperation and develop friendship relations with all countries, including all countries in Europe and including the United States. And for that, I think China has presented a very strong attitude of cooperation. Frank speaking, China has not made a lot of demands on the others or made a lot of complaints about others, but rather China already to answer questions and this or that kind. So if I have a question, I would say whether the United States and Europe ready to try to treat China as equal partner. Thank you.
Thanks, Ambassador. Jim Clifton.
Thank you, Giles. I've had something that bothers me economically that I can't get to add up. So I'm just going to get that off my chest and see if anybody could answer this. But You know, when we had the dot-com bubble, very smart people, the smartest people on Wall Street and economists all over the world, finally gave in and determined that cash flow didn't matter, and that there was something called value in eyeballs. But that's still the biggest scam the devil ever pulled on the entire world. And the people who had the wool pulled over their eyes, it's still breathtaking to me that nobody could see that cash flow does matter. Well, now I read in every magazine that China will go to $40 trillion and America will go to $25 trillion, something like that. I don't see where that cash flow comes from. And the reason I say that is that right now, the United States, our consumers, are $7 trillion in debt. So what we did is we handed out credit cards, we refinanced our houses, and we came up with several trillion dollars more money. What we did is we ran to Walmart and just ran up debt. Walmart is really China's best trade partner, not the United States. When the goods come over, 20% of it goes straight to Walmart. With all due respect, China is Walmart for America. And if you look at the current GNP of that $7 trillion, that's just the benefit of one crazy, reckless spending spree by American consumers. Those are China's best customers. What I don't understand is how everything keeps going. The American consumer is busted. 50 million people have no money in their pockets at all. That's why they complain about gas. That's why they complain about gas prices. So Walmart, who survives to bring great products to poor people, they don't have poor people anymore because those 50 million don't have any moving around money at all. That was China's money. So those 50 million people, they're not going to get rich in the next 10 years. At some point, America has to take a breath and start paying that debt down. Now, China did something very smart, and that is they loaned us a few trillion so we could keep our shopaholics at the Walmart and out at the buying the China products. But it's just a little warning. Where does the China economy go? Don't think the rest of the world. The United States is one-third of the total GNP. But I'm happy to say that the rest of the world isn't as crazy as Americans when it comes to shopping. But I think China needs to take into consideration when dealing with the EU, when dealing with America, that what you see here may be the same bubble.
Thanks very much, Jim. Okay, let's bounce both of the questions, and in fact all five of them, first of all off Hervé and David, and then we'll go to Washington. Hervé.
Well, I think I have to comment on the Taiwan question. I think I made my point already. As well say, there is one China policy. This is a policy of the EU. It's well known. We have supported, we continue to support the statu quo, and we support as well all the efforts which are made by the two parties to come to a negotiated solution. And I must say that we welcome very much the progress achieved in the recent months, for instance, on the cargo flights and the passenger flights which have been negotiated and agreed upon. On the remark of Ambassador Ma on China not an equal partner, I mean, just here to register that I totally disagree. I mean, we consider China not only as an equal partner but as a big, big, big partner. And I think the strategic partnership, which has been decided upon 3 years ago now between the European Union and China, is an illustration of that. So I don't think we've got hear any reason to use or to say that we do not consider China as an equal partner. We consider China as a partner with which we want to cooperate, and I think we have demonstrated in many areas that we can cooperate extremely well.
Thanks, Hervé. David.
Well, those questions ranged fairly widely. I mean, on the issue of global imbalances and a soft landing for the American economy, I mean, that's a whole other debate. All I can say is that people have been talking about the need for structural adjustment and a soft landing for a long time, and it still hasn't happened. But I think a lot of people are worried about how that structural adjustment may take place. On the issue of a free trade agreement between the European Union and the United States, I don't think you were quoting Chancellor Merkel correctly. Obviously, it's for her to say what she said, but my understanding is that in answer to a question, she said, well, that's an interesting idea. And it is an interesting idea which has been discussed already several times. I fear it is an interesting idea whose time has not yet come, because while the economic relationship between the European Union and the United States is undoubtedly the most important bilateral economic relationship in the world and constitutes a huge degree of interpenetration and interdependence, I think both sides feel that pursuing the multilateral agenda is the best way forward in order to bring the rest of the world along with us in that relationship and not to create a sense of exclusivity between the United States and Europe. But how we can intensify and strengthen the links between the United States and Europe in the economic field is something I think the German presidency of the European Union next year will want to take forward. On the issue of counterfeiting, no, I don't think we still consider this to be a very important issue, and I think, frankly, it is an issue on which we agree 100% with the United States, because in both cases, it's a very big challenge facing our industry as we move into higher value-added, become less concerned with low-cost production, and intellectual ownership, ideas, knowledge, innovation is our key source of competitiveness. How to protect that and how to ensure that our companies can keep that value is a critical issue. China is a country where we feel there's a lot of progress needed. I must say, I was with Mr. Mandelson in China in June. It was, I think, his third trip to China, and he said that he noticed very distinct progress on the issue. Progress, I would say, more in terms of awareness and sensitivity to the issue in all the interlocutors we met. We're still concerned about implementation. That's a concern I think we share with the United States. I know also that it is an issue which will become important within China as China moves into more knowledge-intensive industries and innovation itself. The need to have better intellectual property protection within China will become a necessity also for domestic reasons. Finally, China as a partner. I mean, I think China is accepted as a partner, but of course, China has also to want to play the role which is commensurate with the idea of being a partner for the EU, the US, in the global economy. If I may close with the example of the Doha Round, I think China could be more active in the Doha discussions. I think China could be trying to help in promoting a successful outcome from that round. I understand China's concern as a recently acceded member and feeling that it has already paid at the door, so to speak, and not anxious to have to pay a second time. But I do think that these are areas where China, the role that China plays is very much also in China's hands. And it's not just a question of how people in Europe or China treat, how people in Europe or the United States treat China. It's also the extent to which China progressively begins to assume responsibilities for some of these global issues, commensurate with its weight and its action in the global economy.
Thank you, David. Bates, over to you to wrap up. Does America treat China unfairly?
Well, it's difficult to wrap up such an interesting debate, but I'll give it a shot here. Let me try and address two of the questions which were raised. The first, the question of partnership with China. The second, on the issue of Taiwan. I think, Ambassador Ma, if I may say so, you protesteth too much, to quote William Shakespeare. The history of the last 30 to 35 years of international affairs is a history of a gradual and intensifying embrace of China. into the international system. There is no doubt about that. The United States and Europe, through their open markets, have been absolutely and fundamentally critical for China's enormous success. That's a partnership. That's a joint recognition of our shared interests in assuring joint economic prosperity. And China, Europe, and the United States have been absolutely central in partnering in achieving that. I fear sometimes that perhaps for historical reasons, some good, some bad, China fears containment, China fears victimization at the hands of greater powers. I think that history is long behind us. And it's very clear through the EU-China strategic partnership, as well as through efforts of some 7 or 8 American presidents of both parties, that it is our very real goal to bring China into the international system as a fully fledged partner, assuming both the benefits and the responsibilities of that, as David has just noted. So I think I would not fear that China is not seen as a partner. If anything, we want to see China as more, even more, of a partner going forward. On the question of Taiwan, I'm somewhat encouraged, actually, by the current situation across the Taiwan Strait. There's been some very difficult times in recent years. But the political system in Taiwan is changing in a way which I think will moderate extreme voices on both sides of that political spectrum. And also we're moving in a direction, I think, in terms of cross-strait relations where other factors, whether they be economic or cultural or political, are also moving in a direction that's going to help moderate relations across the Taiwan Strait. So I think we ought to be relatively encouraged that we can move in future more positively in a direction that's going to bring about stability and prosperity for the people of Taiwan as well as China, and importantly, improve the expectation that Taiwan can play an even greater role in the international system. So I'm relatively positive that that can come forward. I'm very encouraged in this respect from the repeated and forceful statements in recent years by our friends in Europe insisting that the outcome of the relationship between China and Taiwan be done in a way that's peaceful, in a way that's satisfactory to the peoples of both sides of that question. I think Europe joins with the United States in pointing that it is in our interest to see that outcome, as it is China's and as it is Taiwan's. We surely, again, to speak of our common interests, we do share a moderation of differences across the Taiwan Strait and going forward, finding ways that we can take advantage of the talents and the contributions which the people of Taiwan can surely bring to the international system.
Bates Gill, many thanks for that. And thanks to you and your colleagues at CSIS for having made this latest Atlantic Rendezvous possible. My thanks to the European Commission delegation in Washington, without whose support these very interesting Atlantic discussions wouldn't be possible. Thank you also to the Gallup organization for making available their Washington Palace. And thanks to us, both of us, our two speakers, our panelists, for coming here today. We break now. I think coffee is served downstairs. There are copies available also of the poll that I mentioned. And then we reconvene here in about a quarter of an hour's time for the debate on the forging the EU-China partnership. Thank you very much indeed. And goodbye to you in Washington.